From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll hear reactions to the Supreme Court ruling in favor of a Colorado baker who refused to sell a wedding cake to a gay couple.
We're excited that the Supreme Court has decided to protect religious freedom for everybody. Justice Kennedy's opinion can be summed up as tolerance is a two-way street.
No one should have to face the shame, embarrassment, and humiliation of being told, we don't serve your kind here, that we faced, and we will continue fighting until no one does.
Also today, to kick off WBUR's BioBoom series, we'll decode the language of biotech.
They don't want to know what disease are you working on. They want to know, you know, what vertical is your play?
And we'll look at why Massachusetts is the international biotech hub.
It seems to be a space where we will be consistently strong for the foreseeable future.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In a highly controversial and closely watched case, the United States Supreme Court today ruled in favor of a Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. In 2012, baker Jack Phillips refused to bake a wedding cake for David Mullins and Charlie Craig, saying their same-sex marriage violated his deeply held religious beliefs. The couple filed a complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission and won, a decision which was upheld by the Colorado Court of Appeals. But today's 7-2 Supreme Court ruling overturns that decision. Phillips' lawyer, Michael Ferris, celebrated today's decision.
This case was decided because the Colorado was religiously biased against Jack Phillips, didn't show religious tolerance, didn't treat free exercise appropriately, and basically said religious people aren't free to be in the marketplace. And this is a reverse of that.
But many gay rights activists and legal analysts point to the very narrow scope of today's ruling, saying that that could be a victory for them. Here's David Mullins.
This doesn't mean that the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act has been invalidated in any way. And we will continue fighting until no one has to experience the shame, embarrassment, and humiliation of being told, we don't serve your kind here.
Well, there is a lot to dig into here. So let's start with Noah Feldman. He's a professor at Harvard Law School, constitutional law expert. Professor Feldman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, I mean, first of all, how would you describe the scope and import of today's Supreme Court decision?
It's very narrowly written. Rather than declare that there is a simple solution to the deep question of what we do when people's equality to marry who they wish runs into somebody's liberty to make a cake or not make a cake with a message that he doesn't approve of, the court went narrow. The court instead simply said that under these particular facts, a commissioner of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission disparaged the religious beliefs of the cake baker, Jack Phillips, and for that reason, that under this particular procedure that applied to Phillips, needed to be overturned and done over again because his religious liberty was violated. So it's not a decision that resolved the big questions that were at stake in this case.
Right. In fact, Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority in his opinion, said that really, as you said, the issue was the hostility, in his words, that the Colorado Commission showed to the religious beliefs of Jack Phillips, right?
Exactly. And that is not the way that the parties who argued this case and took it all the way to the Supreme Court were thinking about it. The whole question of this particular quotes by the Civil Rights Commissioner only arose at oral argument in the case. It hadn't been briefed by the parties. It hadn't been focused on at all. And one way to interpret what Kennedy did is that he was trying to duck declaring some grand solution to the problem by instead focusing on the particularities of this particular process.
Right. Can I just jump in here, Professor Feldman? Sorry, but I just want to...
Sure.
I mean, Justice Kennedy pointed to a specific statement that was made by a Colorado commissioner in 2014, and that statement, I'm just going to sort of paraphrase here, was
sure.
About whether it be slavery or the Holocaust, we can list hundreds of situations where freedom of religion has been used to justify discrimination. And to that commissioner, it was one of the, quote, most despicable pieces of rhetoric that people can use to use their religion to hurt others. Now, Justice Kennedy, in his majority opinion, wrote, that basically that sentiment is inappropriate, in his words, for a commission charged with the responsibility of fair and, key thing, neutral enforcement of Colorado's anti-discrimination law.
Yeah, so the way Kennedy decided the case is just to say that the fact that this one commissioner said this, and by the way, he didn't say it in a definitive disposition of the case, he just said it when he was thinking it over and talking it over in the course of a public hearing, was enough to say that this particular cake baker hadn't gotten a fair process because the government, that is to say the commissioner, had shown disparagement or hostility towards his religious beliefs.
Right. And in fact, Justice Kennedy pointed to three other cases that the Colorado Commission Against Discrimination had decided in the same period of time where bakers had been asked by someone to bake a cake with decorations that were opposed to gay marriage. They refused to bake those cakes, and the commission found that they weren't discriminating.
So this is a very tricky part of the opinion, and you'll have to, or your listeners will have to excuse us for going into the weeds just a tiny bit, because the justices actually split over these three other cases.
Right.
So these cases all arose when one particular person who was trying to kind of make a point on the other side went to three different bakers and asked them to bake a cake with disparagement of gay marriage. And as it happens, all those bakers said no. And so then this person went to the same Civil Rights Commission and said, hey, my religious rights were violated because they wouldn't bake these cakes. And the commission did not find that these three bakers had broken the rules. Now, why it didn't do so, it was exactly what was at issue here. Kennedy said that it didn't give a good enough reason for why it distinguished one set of cases from the other set of cases, why it said it was wrong to bake, to refuse to bake a cake for a gay couple, but not wrong to refuse to bake a cake that had anti-gay messages. And so that's, Kennedy used that as his basis for striking it down. Other justices who concurred even in the majority's opinion, and this is the part where it goes into the weeds, split on what should have happened in those cases. On the one hand, the liberals who voted with Kennedy, Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer, said that in their opinion, the court simply should have said, that, and the commission should have just said with respect to those other three cakes, that they're not homophobic and they don't violate, the bakers were not homophobic, so they didn't violate the civil rights rules. And so there's nothing wrong with the denial of baking cakes in those cases.
Yeah.
That's their opinion. That's what they think should happen when this case goes back again. But Justice Gorsuch, Neil Gorsuch, joined by Justice Alito, who were also part of the same majority, took the opposite perspective. And they said, essentially, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And if, in the end, the court is going to allow bakers not to bake a cake with an anti-gay sentiment, then it follows that the same commission has to treat the guy who won't bake the cake for the gay couple in exactly the same way. So the court is split on that issue.
And I understand, and I grant to listeners that it might be a little hard to follow because it is in the legal weeds. But, I mean, it's important, though, because, again, to go back to Justice Kennedy's majority opinion, he's basically saying that because of all these particularities around the Phillips case, also the fact that it was in 2000, the initial events happened in 2012 before gay marriage was legalized in Colorado. Because of all these specifics, he wants his decision or the court's decision to apply to this case only. And that's why people are saying it's very narrowly tailored. But, I mean, Professor Feldman, let me ask you, is that how it's going to be seen or even applied in future cases going forward?
Well, that's what the conservatives and the liberals were fighting about in their concurring opinions. The liberals want this to be a one-time-only case, and Kennedy's opinion leaves room for that. And the conservatives want this to be a precedent that says that if you refuse to bake a cake for a gay couple, you can get away with that. And that's why they wrote their concurrence in their way. And since both of them voted for the same opinion of Kennedy's, Kennedy's opinion was necessarily vague on this question. Mm-hmm. So it really did not offer guidance. And so now it's going to be fought out. The same discussion that you and I just had in the last 90 seconds is going to be replayed in the Colorado courts and very possibly in other courts around the country.
Okay, so it's going to be replayed in the Colorado courts because this has to be re-decided then? Or is the Supreme Court's ruling?
Because all that the opinion said was that this particular process has to be set aside. It didn't say what happens after it's set aside. Do they start from scratch and this time, without using any religious animus, still find against the baker, which is what the liberals would like to happen? Or do they start from scratch and say, okay, this is over, the baker goes free, well, he was never going to prison, but the baker is not civilly sanctioned, and neither will anybody else in a similar situation. That's what the conservatives want. So now that the whole thing goes back to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission and eventually to the Colorado court.
Professor Noah Feldman, stand by here for just a second, because we got lots of other people who I just want to hear their takes on this really complicated but important Supreme Court decision. So let me just turn briefly, if I can, to David French. He's a senior writer at National Review, joining us today via Skype. David French, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me back. I appreciate it.
Also with us is Carol Rose, executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts. Carol Rose, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So, Carol, let me just start with you. You heard Professor Feldman sort of dissect the legal specifics in the rulings, the concurrences, and we didn't touch on Justice Ginsburg's dissent, which I will in a second. But do you really think this is as narrowly tailored as it's being described?
Yeah, no, I think it's an incredibly narrow ruling. I mean, specifically, the court did not say that there was a reason that you could discriminate, that you can use religion to discriminate against people. And I think it's important to also understand the distinction that the concurring opinion by Kagan made in terms of the cases where the bakers refused to put actually homophobic messages on the cakes. You know, as Kagan wrote, a vendor can choose the products that he sells, but not the customers he serves, no matter the reason. So I think it's important for people to realize that there is no change to the longstanding rule that businesses that are open to the public have to be open to everyone.
David French, your take.
I think it's broader. It's obviously not as broad as it could have been. I mean, both sides are going into this wanting a sweeping decision on the baker side, saying that a custom designed cake is protected expression and that requiring him to make a cake for a gay wedding would be compelled speech in violation of the Constitution. Conversely, you know, the other side was saying, no, it's not protected expression and there's no religious liberty issue here because public accommodation laws are neutral laws of general applicability. And so neither side got what it wanted on the maximalist position. But I think the opinion here is actually broader than many people realize in the real world. And that is because had the opinion stopped only with the commissioner's comments, this would have been an extremely narrow fact-specific case. Mm-hmm. But because it went on and it discussed the double standards and did so in a way that certainly made two liberal members of the court uncomfortable enough to write their own separate opinion, because it went into the broader double standard, what you now are looking at is a real-world situation where if you want to impose some sort of requirement on, say, a baker or similar type of vendor, then you had better be sure that that record demonstrates that your treatment of similarly situated people, say religious people who are protected under public accommodation law every bit as much as a same-sex couple, that religious people, when they have sought to have their messages put on or their expression put into, say, a cake, that they've been treated the same way. Where things get difficult.
Yeah, so I'm sorry to jump in here, but to this point, though, exactly, it does seem as if Justice Kennedy is, you know, he went to the pains of saying, well, there are a myriad of different situations one can imagine with different decorations, different requests, all sorts of things. And he says in the end of his opinion, the outcome of cases like this in other circumstances must await further elaboration in the court. So, you know, where's the broad real world impact that you're talking about?
Yeah, well, but he did not just leave it like, well, you know, you say tomato, I say tomato. It's who the heck knows. He does begin to outline some specifics. So, for example, in the free speech point, he starts to explore like, does the cake actually have a message on it? In other words, does it have actual words, implying that that's a different case from where a cake doesn't have any words or any symbols at all? What are the specifics of the public accommodation law? And what you often find again, going back to the real world, is these cases arise in a context of larger sets of decisions. And these larger sets of decisions, because these civil rights commissions are often very, very political, what you will tend to find as a pattern is a pattern of favoritism to one point of view or another. Well, and that's where you're going to get shut down after this decision.
Carol Rose, let me turn back to you for a second, because I'm seeing, you know, you pick any paragraph in Justice Kennedy's opinion and there's something interesting to talk about, because I'm seeing here he says, you know, if exceptions were not confined, then a long list of persons who provide goods and services for marriages and weddings might refuse to do so for gay persons, thus resulting in a community-wide stigma inconsistent with the history and dynamics of civil rights laws. Basically, warning against, expanding the scope of what he means to say in this ruling.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, Justice Kennedy makes it clear, and then, you know, some of the other, both in the concurring and dissenting opinions, make it very clear that they don't want a broad reading of this. And in fact, what they talk about are the specific facts that the Colorado Civil Rights Commissioners said certain things that seem to be the meaning of religion. And what that says to me is that, you know, it's possible. They didn't go to the actual merits of the case. What they said is that the hostility towards religion that was, you know, voiced by these commissioners tainted the adjudication process. They didn't say that religion will trump equality. And in fact, they went to great lengths to say that, in fact, that's not the correct reading of the case. And so I think what we have here is a requirement that adjudicatory bodies, when they take on these cases to see, when they're balancing these rights, to make sure that they're, you know, respectful of religion. And I think it'll be interesting to find out if the court uses the same sort of reasoning in the Muslim travel ban case that they're going to be deciding, where the President of the United States was very demeaning of religion, of Muslim religion in any event, of Islam. And so it'll be interesting to see whether or not they say that you cannot have that kind of adjudication or you can't pass laws when the state is disrespectful of religion.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting ruling that has implications even beyond the same-sex marriage and equal rights implications of this case.
David French, your quick thought on that.
Well, that's where I'm going to agree with my friend from the ACLU. I found that very interesting. Now, Kennedy, again, as we keep saying, you know, if you want to find aid and comfort in a Kennedy opinion, you will find aid and comfort. If you want to find something to discourage you, you'll find something to discourage you. But one of the interesting things to me were some of the quotes that he made, or that some of the things that he said surrounding evidence of discriminatory animus towards religion. And while he did not come right out and say that, for example, lawmaker comments as a matter of law should be considered in the analysis, he distinguished the situation by saying, well, you know, some have said lawmaker comments, but this involves the actual adjudicators. There were certainly enough language in there to indicate to me, oh, I am seeing why the Supreme Court accepted the travel ban case and specifically wanted briefing on the Establishment Clause issues in that case. And I feel like we're going to get an opinion one way or the other in the travel ban case that really starts to more carefully and sharply define the parameters of when do you consider the stated motivations of a lawmaker.
Well, David French, senior writer at National Review, joining us today via Skype. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Carol Rose, executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts, thank you as well.
Thank you.
We've still gotten Professor Noah Feldman from Harvard Law School on the line, but I want to get into other voices here, if I can. Mary Bonato, she is the Civil Rights Project Director at GLAAD. She's one of the legal architects that led to or advocated for many years for the legalization of same-sex marriage, both here in Massachusetts and in the United States more broadly. Mary Bonato, welcome back to you.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Andrew Beckwith. He's president of the Massachusetts Family Institute. Andrew Beckwith, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So, Mary and Andrew, what I wanted to discuss with you is sort of the legal particulars of both the decision and the dissent today really matter. But I just want to get a sense from you, from both of you, what you think the national implications more broadly are. Mary, is this a setback for gay civil rights?
I don't see this as a setback for civil rights for gay people or anyone else for that matter. I mean, the government does have a command to treat religion neutrally, and I might have evaluated some of the evidence a little differently from how the court did, particularly with respect to that other baker who was trolling around for anti-gay cakes. But, you know, when it comes to comments that are hostile to religion and so on, I think you can understand the point of view of the court to say this was not a neutral consideration of the case. It was not impartial, and it has to be set aside. I recognize that means that these two individuals don't have, the cake that they deserved and the civil rights and the dignity that they deserved. But I don't see this as a big setback. Quite the contrary.
Mary, just going to jump in here, though, because we haven't yet talked about Justice Ginsburg's dissent. And she basically looked at all the reasoning that Anthony Kennedy put forward and says she agrees with all those reasonings, but she thinks that the exact opposite conclusion should have been reached, that everything that Anthony Kennedy said about the differing cases and the differing standards, in her mind, made the Colorado Commission's decision the right one. Now, but she's in the minority of two there. Does that not concern you?
It doesn't. The reason I am not overly concerned about that is because when I read the opinion, you know, you see cases that were cited by the Baker being used in support of non-discrimination. There was just constant reference to the importance of non-discrimination laws, the vitality of them, how they do not generally offend the First or 14th Amendments, citing the, you know, famous Piggy Park case from over 50 years ago that really firmed up the idea that in this nation, when you're open to the public, you're open to everyone. There were many references to stigma that would be effectuated against gay people if you allowed religion to be used to discriminate. There was just so much about the importance of anti-discrimination laws that it's pretty hard, I think, to dial that back.
Yeah. Andrew Beckwith, your take on today's decision.
Well, I think in a sense I would agree with Mary that today's decision shouldn't be viewed as a setback for gay civil rights, in the sense that gay civil rights shouldn't require forcing people to violate their sincerely held religious belief in order to be seen as successful. So we see this as a 7-2 win for religious freedom for people of all faiths, affirming that they don't have to leave their sincerely held beliefs at the workplace door.
Hmm. Mary Bonato, there's another point of Justice Ginsburg's dissent I just want to read to you. She said, when a couple contacts a bakery for a wedding cake, the product they are seeking is a cake celebrating their wedding, not a cake celebrating heterosexual weddings or same-sex weddings. And that is the service Craig and Mullins, the gay couple, were denied.
Yeah, I think she has a fantastic... I'm not saying I disagree with Justice Ginsburg's dissent. I don't. I think she has the better of the argument, but I also understand the point of view of the court about you can't have a commission that at least ostensibly is charged with deciding this thing and so on, even though, as Professor Feldman noted, some of the comments that were not made in the context of actually literally deciding the case. But you can't have this apparent hostility to religion going on. What can I say? I agree. And I think beyond that, you know, this idea of a double standard that Mr. French was referring to and so on with the cakes of the person who wanted the anti-gay cakes and what is this going to mean going forward, I want to say that I don't view this as a very big deal either, because going forward, I think it's really pretty simple for people who make products to say, we are not going to disparage other people, other religions, you know, when we make products for any reason, and if that's your policy, nobody can make you make cake. And, you know, I think these bakers maybe didn't, I mean, they had that policy in practice, but I think if that had been firmed up and it's firmed up going forward, that we're not going to have an issue here. And by contrast, I don't agree with what Mr. Beckwith just said at all. I don't think that's what the case said today at all, that you can use your religion to discriminate, that the opinion was careful to say exactly not that. But what I'm trying to say is that, if you have a policy that says we're not going to disparage people for any reason, that is a very, very different thing from, you know, a baker like Mr. Phillips who makes wedding cakes but refused to make a wedding cake as a matter of policy only for same-sex couples.
Well, let me give Andrew Beckwith a chance to respond to that.
Sure. I mean, the discrimination that the court ruled against today was the state-based discrimination against a person of faith and his religious beliefs. And they found that the Colorado Commission was disparaging towards both Mr. Phillips and his belief. And it's a belief that's shared by millions and millions of Americans, that marriage is the union of one man and one woman. And the court reaffirmed today that, quote, religious and philosophical objections to gay marriage are protected views. And so but what this decision says is that when you have these conflicts between, say, you know, gay civil rights and the constitutional right to free expression, free exercise of religion, that there is a balancing test, and that the state, the government, can't put its thumb on the scales because it doesn't like the religious views of one of the parties.
Mm. Yeah, I don't want to mix apples and oranges here, because on the one hand, the decision itself, and I'm looking at it, says even though we have to respect, of course, not only the rights of gay people to be treated with dignity and respect, but also religious and philosophical objections, It is the general rule that such objections do not allow business owners and other actors in the economy and in society to deny protected persons equal access to goods and services. So I think the courts are resolved where it stands on that issue.
Mm. Well, you know, we're just about to run out of time here, and obviously there's a much deeper discussion to be had, and we will continue to do so. But Mary Bonato, Civil Rights Project Director for GLAAD, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Andrew Beckwith, President of the Massachusetts Family Institute, thank you as well.
Happy to be here.
Noah Feldman, we've just got a minute left to go here. Mm-hmm. We heard a lot of legal nuance in the past 25 minutes or so.
You sure did.
But I just want to get, again, in the minute we have here, your last big picture take. Did the court miss an opportunity to provide some much-needed legal guidance on this issue of what happens or what should happen when matters of religious belief do bump up against questions of civil liberties or gay rights?
I would say the court self-consciously knowingly skipped an opportunity to provide some guidance, because this is a very difficult issue and the justices themselves couldn't reach consensus on it. A lot of us can agree that everyone deserves equal dignity. A lot of us believe that individuals are also entitled to religious liberty. What do you do when those conflict? This is a deep existential problem. The court didn't have the answers. It didn't have five votes lined up behind the answers, so they didn't answer it.
Well, Noah Feldman is a professor of law at Harvard Law School. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Magna.
Well, you know, guessing that you guys folks have a lot of reactions and questions and comments about today's Supreme Court ruling, so send us a tweet at Radio Boston, or you could hop over to our website, radioboston.org, and let us know what you think there. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. More than 16,000 people in the biotech industry have descended on Boston for the 2018 Bio International Convention. It's getting underway today. And many of those scientists, entrepreneurs, and investors probably didn't have to travel very far, because Boston and Cambridge are widely considered home to the world's premier cluster in the biotech industry. I mean, just get this. 18 of the top 20 pharma companies have a major presence here, along with hundreds of small, medium, and big biotech companies. So all this week, WBUR is taking a closer look at the bio boom here. It's a special series. We're looking at the impact it's having on the region. And here with me to introduce the series is WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so BioBoom. Tell us a little bit about the series this
week.
Yes.
So the series is centered in Kendall Square, Cambridge, which, as you know, is the epicenter of biotech here. And some of us would argue in the world, but we might be being a little bit partisan and parochial there.
One of the epicenters.
Yes,
that?
I don't know if you can have more than one, but anyway. And it's we look at it, you know, its transformation over the last couple, three decades, but lately more than ever. If you've been there recently, like, it's just this forest of gleaming buildings, and everybody has a PhD, and sandwiches are $12 even if you take them out. You know, it's just, it's a whole ecosystem, and most importantly, I think it's becoming a characteristically Boston thing to be in biotech. I mean, of course, biotech exists elsewhere. There's, you know, there's quite a bit of competition from the West Coast, but it's now a Boston flavor. Like, you could say, you know, there were elites elsewhere, but a Boston Brahmin was a particular thing. Well, biotech has become very Boston-y. It's a quickly growing population that's very new Boston. It's very knowledge economy. It's at the intersection of science and medicine and business. So we're taking a big look at it.
Okay. So tell us a little bit more then about the series. Which parts or angles of that boom do you highlight?
Well, so this morning we had a big overview by reporter Karen Weintraub that was kind of quantifying the growth in this sector. I mean, you can eyeball it if you go back to Kendall Square, and every time
just
you go
walk
there,
around,
right,
yeah,
you're like, oh my God, where did all these buildings go? There's like 10 new buildings, and that happens like every year if you go back. And then tomorrow, Bruce Gellerman spins the yarn of the wild roller coaster ride that the big, really iconic biotech company Vertex has been on, mainly with drugs for cystic fibrosis, but others others as well. And we'll also tomorrow look at biotech startups and the purported road to riches that's actually full of sinkholes.
Right, because, I mean, many of these biotech companies, or startups in particular, do fail.
Yeah, most.
Okay, but Carrie, you are looking into some of the more fun parts of the industry,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so I reserved for myself the most fun stories. So I dig into the subculture of biotech, and I look at what you could call the tribes of Kendall Square and the lingo that you might hear there. Also, Morning Edition looks into Moderna, which is a company that's really worth knowing about because it's a big biotech unicorn. It's a private company valued at billions that's working on a technology called messenger RNA. And so all in all, we, and this includes Radio Boston, will also look at biotech's effects on the communities around it, beyond Cambridge even, positive and negative effects, and efforts at greater diversity in the industry. And on Thursday, Richard Knox will report on new efforts to figure out creative ways to pay for the cutting-edge treatments that come out of biotech, because they can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
All right. So a really big look here across the week in this series. And you're also including a look ahead to the future of the industry as well?
Yep. So that'll be at the end of the week. A couple of stories on that. One on the widespread prediction that the next chapter for biotech will be, everyone's talking about convergence, the convergence of biology with technology, with big data, with AI, with information technology, even more so than now. And then there's also the question of whether biotech is in a bubble. This is kind of a perennial question in the industry. So we look at that as well. So, you know, all in all, Meghna, it's kind of it's a way of maybe trying to cement in our Bostonian public mind that, you know, just as Harvard is a big deal, everyone's heard of it, and Mass General is man's greatest hospital, it's famous. The biotech of Kendall Square and beyond has become another iconic piece of greater Boston and a major economic engine to boot.
Okay, so let's go back to what you said just a minute earlier about the lingo.
Yeah.
You have a piece out today that's a primer on how to speak basic biotech.
Yes.
I'm always willing to learn a new language here, so
okay.
Can you teach me some buzzwords?
Sure. So I was recently tutored myself in biotech ease by Jeff Krasner, who covered biotech for the Globe, and now he has a biotech communications company. He says there are certain words you hear so often in biotech that they become almost completely meaningless. Words like transformative or disruptive or innovative, right? It basically all just means new.
I would say in every sector, those are becoming meaningless.
Yes, but biotech particularly. And he says also among the venture capitalists who invest in biotech, there's a particular vocabulary for so for example, let's say you want to start a biotech company. What do you need?
Money.
You need an idea.
Oh, yeah, an idea too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right? Okay, so you need an initial injection of capital. Here's Jeff Krasner on that.
Well, usually it's seed financing or angel financing, which is sometimes described as friends and family. And then you get to a certain point where actually this introduces another interesting term, which is POC, P-O-C, as a verb. We're going to POC that compound.
So POC, proof of concept, which means, you know, a scientist has to advance their idea or technology enough they can prove to investors that it's worth investing in. But meanwhile, Meghna, your company could languish in the biotech space known as the Valley of Death.
The Valley of Death is in between the time when you've got an interesting compound, it's a great idea, but before it's good enough for people to actually invest in it. And there's a lot of people trapped in the Valley of Death right now.
Right now. Well, Carrie, we could talk biotech all day, couldn't we?
We could. That would be very transformative and innovative, yes.
Not to mention disruptive.
Yeah,
teach me more.
Too.
Or we'd end up in the Valley of Death of radio.
but we have a whole post with lots and lots of buzzy biotech words to learn.
Well, as WBUR's Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg, we've got a link, again, as she said, at radioboston.org, plus BioBoom all week this week. So,
all week.
So Carrie Goldberg, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
We'll be back in just a moment with more on Massachusetts biotech. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, all this week on WBUR, we're looking at the growth of the state's biotech industry and its impact, both positive and perhaps not so positive, on Massachusetts. It's all part of WBUR's bio boom series. Now, state government has made major investments in the life sciences. Back in 2008, Governor Deval Patrick signed a 10-year, $1 billion initiative to bolster the life sciences industry in Massachusetts. A decade later, the state legislature is expected to pass a measure that would invest another $500 million in life sciences over the next 5 years and increase the tax credit to biotech companies for research and development that takes place here in Massachusetts. Now, the Massachusetts Life Sciences Center oversees this funding. It's a quasi-public investment agency dedicated to supporting life sciences in the Commonwealth. We caught up with Travis McCready recently. He's the president and CEO of the Massachusetts Life Sciences Center, and we asked him for his take on the state's bio boom.
The boom is decades in the making, and it now seems to be taking on an absolutely frenetic pace as a result of a number of different economic advances, scientific advances, cultural advances, demographic shifts. It all seems to be coming together in favor of us being now recognized as the world leader in the life sciences. And that includes biotech, but it also includes med device, diagnostics, digital health. All of these areas are sort of collapsing in on each other, and they all seem to be areas of strength for us in the Commonwealth. So this boom is real, not just as an economic boom, but as a scientific boom. It's very real.
Is it sustainable?
Well, it's sustainable from the standpoint of we have strength in these subsectors. It's an economic endeavor, so yeah, it will be subject to exogenous economic forces, federal law changes, investment capital availability, but it seems to be a space where we will be consistently strong for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Folks in the sector, the life sciences sector broadly, talk about, you know, the ecosystem.
Yes.
That it takes to really nurture and grow life sciences, and that because Massachusetts has done a great job in tending to that ecosystem,
yes,
it's one of the reasons why we're in the midst of this boom, right?
Right.
So there's, you know, there's the supporting R&D, there's the world-class educational institutions, there's, you know, arguably the state could be doing more in sort of building a pipeline from even the lower grades to, you know, educating the workforce
precisely
for the future. Now, there's also the issue of direct investment.
Yes.
That the Commonwealth has made, right?
Yes.
Because, well, it was a decade ago, exactly.
That's right.
Where under Governor Deval Patrick, the state embarked on a $1 billion life sciences initiative.
That's right.
Regarding that part of the puzzle specifically, how would you describe, has it been successful or not, that investment?
This 10-year initiative was designed to accomplish a couple of things that simply would not have taken place with just private sector or not-for-profit investment. One is it's this infrastructure, this notion that in order to be engaged in scientific endeavors, in order to spread this ecosystem out beyond Cambridge and Boston, scientists need to have access to the stuff.
The lab space.
The lab space.
The equipment.
The incubators, the equipment. All of those tangible things that, you know, the private sector isn't great at investing in for shared use. And our initiative has been unapologetic and very clear that we're investing in that those infrastructure across the entire state. The second part has been our focus on workforce and workforce development. We run the single largest life sciences internship program in the United States of America. That's not something, again, which would have been made possible just with private sector investment. And it's fueling this cycle of college students and high school students getting into the industry, gaining full-time employment, and then going on and becoming scientists in their own right.
Governor Patrick, when he announced the initiative back in 2008, said it was going to create 250,000 jobs.
Yes.
How many has it created?
Well, I mean, I can guarantee you this. It hasn't been 250,000. But if you take a look at the combination of the jobs that were created as a result of the capital investments, which have been about 2,000, the jobs that have been created by the tax incentive program, about 9,500 plus and growing. The internships that we've created, another 3,600 over the past 10 years. The capital investment that's come in sort of following the investments we've made in early stage startup companies. There's been about $3 billion total of follow-on investment and an untold number of jobs that are attached to those $3 billion. I think that while we haven't created 250,000 jobs directly as a result of our work, what we have done is we've created an ecosystem and supported an ecosystem that's gone on to support primary, secondary, and tertiary job growth, not just in the sciences, but also in legal, accounting, PR, construction, and all the other jobs that we just don't have any way of counting and tracking.
Okay. To be a pain about this, though.
Yeah.
I mean, when Governor Patrick said 250,000 jobs, that was an eye-opening, you know, admirable number to aim for.
Absolutely.
The numbers that you just put in front of us don't even amount to 10% of that. Folks, for example, at the Pioneer Institute a couple of years ago, they put out a report that basically said that the Commonwealth hasn't gotten value for its money out of this $1 billion when it comes to those direct jobs.
There are a couple of ways you can think about value for money and ROI. The first, obviously, is the direct number of jobs that are created as a result of our investments, certainly. But then, this is the life sciences, remember. What's important to also note is the direct investments that come into the Commonwealth that are going into these companies and are coming into the academic medical centers as a result of our investment.
Yeah.
And if you take a look at that, the Commonwealth has received three times as much that has come in. So I think that's pretty good value for money. So you have to look at the bigger picture and sort of the network level effects that are taking place as a result of investment.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
It just makes me wonder why elected officials constantly and primarily talk about the direct job growth numbers that are possible out of these investments. I mean, because that is the promise by which they're selling to the voters that this is the best use for this billion or half a billion dollars versus $1 billion to, you know, school districts across the Commonwealth.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Oh, I totally do. And it's, I understand why we do that in economic development across industries, not just the life sciences. But I think the cool thing about this investment and what we've done with the taxpayer dollar is we focused on direct employment. We focused on improving the K-12 public school system. We focused on capital infrastructure investments that will stand the test of time and produce economic results. We focused on regionalization. I would rather, you know, focus on maybe having 100,000 jobs, but have those jobs dispersed across the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Mm. I think that's qualitatively just as important as the quantitative number. I would rather accept as a community a lower number of jobs, knowing that we're addressing issues of inequity, getting economically challenged neighborhoods and cities into the life sciences, rather than just, you know, a massive number of jobs that's focused on wealthier communities and wealthier neighborhoods that wouldn't have been able to participate anyway.
Hmm. A lot of the focus is on Kendall Square because it's virtually unrecognizable from what it was 5 or 10 years ago. But I mean, be honest with me. Do you think the state has done enough? Has it done a good enough job to be sure that Springfield, Holyoke, Worcester, you know, pick your city or town name, has had access to the funds and the support from the state to also, you know, have a boomlets where they are?
Kendall Square is going to be fine. What we needed to do was to create the same conditions for success in Brockton, Lowell, New Bedford, Springfield, Western Massachusetts in the Berkshires, Central Mass around Worcester, Metro West. And that has meant a combination of treatments, if you will. Infrastructure, whether it's co-working spaces, wastewater treatment facilities, education. Ensuring that we've invested in every single vocational technical school in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, investing in the community colleges. We've invested in every single community college in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. That is spread out the access to our funds and the capabilities that come with that access across to all four corners of the Commonwealth. Mm.
There is a proposal for $500 million more.
Yes.
To sort of keep the momentum going here. So another $500 million from the state of Massachusetts. You'd be in charge of handing a lot of that money out. Are you saying that, like, structurally you're going to be looking to invest, sort of in places outside of the greater Boston area?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. We already have. Yeah. There are great assets that exist and great communities that exist outside of the greater Boston area that each have a capability to play in this ecosystem in a different way. That's how we're thinking about Massachusetts. We're thinking about it as a platform of connected cities and towns that each have capabilities, assets, and the capacity to be able to layer into the life sciences ecosystem in a unique and helpful way.
Yeah. Globally, biotech is expected to reach more than $700 billion by 2025. Okay, so it's vast numbers we're talking about here. That's globally, granted. But the point is that it's growing and there's a lot of money in it already.
Yes.
So why does the state need to invest another $500 million?
If you take a look back at the moment in which our organization was created and the $1 billion was authorized 10 years ago, there were 11 states that had life sciences dedicated funds. Obviously, it was Massachusetts, California. We were at the top of the heap. Fast forward to today, there are 44 states with life sciences-focused investment funds. And there are states that are eclipsing us in terms of the growth of the sector that never were even on the map 10 years ago. Utah, Texas. These states have the highest percentage compound annual growth rate in the life sciences of any of the 50 states. So while Massachusetts and California are still number one, the remaining 48 are eroding our market share. So we have to continue to invest to remain competitive.
I was seeing some numbers that in terms of venture capital investment,
yes.
Not from the state, but investment going into the sector.
Yeah.
That in 2017, California captured some $6.5 billion.
Yes.
Massachusetts, some roughly $3 billion in VC funding.
Yes.
But that California, one state, that means more than half.
Yes.
More than 50% of the venture funding for life sciences went to one state.
Yes.
Whereas the other 49 states were fighting over the other half.
Your point is well made, but it also the underlying data would suggest that there's something afoot that's happening in these other 49 states.
Yeah. Indiana, for example, their R&D tax credit is up to 15%.
Yes.
Massachusetts is at about 10%.
Yes.
For direct investments in R&D. Should we be increasing the tax credit?
Yes, that's part of the tools. That's one of the tools that we need to be able to play with. And frankly, we're committed out in terms of what we've been able to accomplish in prior years. And in order to continue to be able to attract the companies that we've been successful attracting and helping the companies grow that have been here and scale that we've been successful scaling, we've run out of ceiling with our tax credit programs.
At what point in time does the bio boom here in Massachusetts and the momentum that it has run headlong into other challenges and realities we have here? Housing, transportation, cost of living. You want to keep people here to work in these industries, but if they can't afford it, even at pretty good paying jobs, what good is it going to do?
We've already run into significant structural community issues that plague every industry. Affordable housing, being able to get people between their place of work, their home, and schools.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time when MassBio conducted their industry snapshot last year, for the first time what popped up on the radar, people expressed a willingness to choose where to live and choose perhaps not to live in the Commonwealth based on their commute time. that had not shown up before. So transportation, housing, these things are not sort of nice to have, exogenous issues that, you know, don't affect the innovation economy. They're real for the innovation economy. I have no control over them, but it's certainly something that we in the industry pay quite a bit of attention to.
Maybe you can talk to Governor Baker about it.
Well, he is, look, he understands it, he gets it, but I think that we as a community need to come up with a better solution for us all.
Yeah. Well, that's Travis McCready, president and CEO of the Massachusetts Life Sciences Center. Tomorrow in WBUR's week-long BioBoom series, we'll take a look at the history and evolution of Kendall Square. We'll be talking to Philip Sharp, the Nobel Prize-winning MIT professor, co-founded Biogen in 1978. 5 years later, he moved it to Binney Street in Cambridge, and in the words of MIT's Tech Review, the biotech industry was born, and Kendall Square would never be the same. That's tomorrow. Thanks for spending the hour with us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.